And 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
And remember, just as a general thing, be registered to vote. There's nothing coming up for the next month or so, but be prepared. Don't wait. Okay. First story, I thought this was kind of interesting slash fun. From the Houston Chronicle, Rooftop Cinema Club's new drive-in theater rolls into Houston's Edo district with holiday movie lineup. Edo is East Downtown. Realtors, what are you going to do with them? The company will preview its new venue, dubbed the Drive-In at Edo, through the month of December before hosting its grand opening in January, according to a release. As its name implies, the new drive-in movie theater is located in Houston's East Downtown Management District, commonly referred to as Edo. During December, moviegoers will benefit from soft launch pricing. Prices do vary by day, and you can get information by going to rooftopcinemaclub.com. That's all one word, rooftopcinemaclub.com. Just briefly, I think that, you know, this is one of those things that's going to sort of change the face of entertainment post-pandemic. People will not feel, I think for the next generation or so, people I don't think will feel safe in movie theaters. I think drive-ins will be the way to go. And with the new technologies they have of weak signal FM and tuning in by your radio and better sound systems in cars, I think that this is something that will probably grow and persist for quite some time.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to replace movie theaters by any means, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised to see a resurgence in drive-in theaters after all this.
I wonder if the multiplexes can't survive. Because, you know, they're built based on volume.
Yeah.
And unless you're coming with a family member or a date, I don't think you're going to want to sit close to strangers anymore. So that creates a seating placement issue. It creates a volume issue. Plus, a lot of movie studios now are releasing films straight to pay view on demand.
Yeah, streaming
or
services.
Straight to cable streaming services, and it's you know this is something they went through when cable TV was first starting, and it's one of these evolutions of why do you, unless you're on a date and you just want the privacy. Or you want to leave the kids home and you just want the privacy. In a day when you can have a TV set hanging on your wall that's anywhere from 40 to 70 or 90 inches wide, why do you need to go to a movie theater? It's just, you know, technology and environment and all these different things impact those sorts of evolutions in society.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be an experience of going to a theater, but I guess if multiplexes go the way of the dodo, then I wonder if that experience will be different.
You might end up with specialty theaters. Theaters that are showing films that aren't going straight to VOD or aren't going straight to premium cable. You know, maybe everything will start to become like the River Oaks Theater, where it's small movies, and it'll become a niche kind of experience. Who knows?
Time will tell.
Okay, next thing, and I think this is something probably people will have heard of by the time this show airs on Monday, which we're, by the way, recording ridiculous hour of Sunday morning, and just let it go at that. Hewlett-Packard is relocating its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Springwoods Village, which is up off I-45, I think a little north of the Grand Parkway. What's interesting about this is, of course, in a sense, while HP has been in the Houston metro area for a while, I don't think they were until they bought Compaq, which was probably something like 10 or so years ago. Compaq used to have its headquarters on what is now US 249 going out to Tomball. It is now an HP facility. It's still there. But this is obviously going to mean jobs and revenue coming into the metro area. They probably will be moving here sometime in the spring of 2021, maybe later, depends on whether the facility is finished.
Well, the article mentions that construction began in February and it's scheduled to complete by spring 2022. So,
but
you know, they might.
That's the whole complex. That isn't necessarily HP's facility. And of course, they might piecemeal.
They're talking about
the Lake Plaza Drive campus.
Okay,
and
I didn't
East Mossy think about Oaks that. Road, basically two campuses.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. It is possible that they can move in stages.
Yeah, it's two 5-story buildings, and of course they might start moving in as floors complete.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about this is that I know that the Houston area used to be the home of a lot more sort of influential computer companies from the early 80s, from the, you know, start of the computer revolution. But, you know, as companies got bought out, companies went out of business, a lot of them moved away or just shuttered their doors and stopped existing. So it's, I don't know if this is a sort of, can be classed as a sort of return to the days of yore or anything, but it's interesting that computing is moving back to this area a little bit.
Well, one thing the story didn't mention is how many people are going to be coming with this headquarters move. But presumably we're talking at least a couple of hundred, I'm guessing, conservatively, very conservatively.
Yeah,
and those people, of course, will place demand on retail facilities and service businesses. And I'm sure there will be providers to HP of services and parts and whatever. Maintenance, I don't know if they'll be, I guess it'll be strictly an administrative facility. But there will be service jobs associated with the very existence of it. That's just inevitable.
Right, right.
Okay, next up, from the Houston Chronicle, school districts worry a fiscal cliff could await them in January. Across the Houston region and Texas, school districts that lost enrollment during the pandemic are facing a drop in state funds starting in January if the Texas Education Agency or state lawmakers do not act. Since the virus began sweeping across the state and nation last March, forcing schools to close, the TEA has given districts several grace periods in which it provided them the same funding they would have received in normal times. To date, that has provided a lifeline to districts that otherwise would have seen their state revenues plunge. The current grace period ends December 31st. The legislature in 2019 set aside money to help lower-income students catch up to their more affluent peers through what is known as compensatory education. Theoretically, I suppose that would mean better internet access. I believe we did a story a few weeks ago where we were talking about maybe having trucks or vans or buses that would act as internet relay stations.
Yeah.
Their educational needs are going to be greater than ever due to the pandemic. Compensatory education is designed to help them catch up when they struggle. Amanda Brownson, Executive Director of Policy and Research for Texas Association of School Business Officers, says, "I worry we'll see cuts in that program, frankly, at a time they'll need it most." I think the thing that it's necessary to remind here is that schools generally receive money based on butts in chairs.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons they're so picky about attendance. If you have a day that you're not in school, they don't get money for the chair you should be sitting in that day.
Right.
And now we're talking about some kids have not re-enrolled. Maybe they've moved. Maybe they're doing at-home learning. Is distance learning the same as having a rear end in a chair for the purposes of funding? Again, this is part of adapting to a new world.
Yeah. Now, so, do you know if funding, if the attendance levels affect just funding from the state or also funding from local property taxes?
Well, local property taxes go to districts.
Okay.
So I don't think that will change.
Okay.
But without state funding and a certain amount of federal funding, schools can't make it. Districts can't make it. There are special programs that get state and or federal funding.
Right.
And then just general education. And I this may also apply, although it's not mentioned in the story, but I imagine state universities in various ways are having similar problems. I don't think that they're funded quite the same way. But when people don't have butts in chairs, it changes the calculus, and the system is not really set up for this calculus in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, I bring it up because, especially considering that property taxes vary wildly depending on, you know, the income level of the population in the district and all this sort of thing, and how many people live in the district.
There are supposed to be, by the way, what they call Robin Hood laws to try to balance that out, but I don't
know how well they work at all. Yeah. I mean, property taxes just end up not being enough for several, a great number of school districts, not just in the state of Texas, but around the country. And so
property tax funding for schools is problematic, which is one of the benefits, quote unquote, of income tax.
Right.
Which is you can have lower property taxes and then you have a progressive income tax, which you use to fund necessary public resources.
Right. But because of that situation we have it as it is, means that districts are really relying on state funding. And if state funding is not recognizing remote learning students as attendance for financial purposes, then this could be an issue. So
All right, let me do a quick break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. You can visit my blog and see my archive, listen to my archive shows and see the various posts with the various article links at thinkwingradio.com. You can follow me on Facebook at Think Wing Radio and also on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And those things don't always have the same posts or the same information. So it just kind of depends on your predisposition.
Yeah.
These days, unfortunately, we cannot take live callers. We're doing pre-recorded shows. That may change at some point in the future, but I honestly cannot tell you when. But KPFT still needs your support to continue broadcasting. Even though we're recording shows from home, there are still utilities that have to be paid, and we still have broadcast towers that have to be maintained, and various other things that require money. So if you could see your way clear at this time, this difficult time, you can either go to kpft.org and click on the donate link, and that will take you through a process. Hopefully, if you pick a show, you'll pick Think Wing Radio. Also, you can text 713-526-5738 and text the word give. So 713-526-5738, it'll take you through the process. And any donation, large, small, or in between, is appreciated. If you haven't helped support KPFT in a while, maybe if you can, this would be a good time to, you know, pledge $25 or $50 or $100 or $10 a month or a lot of different ways. Yeah. And you can go through all of that either at the donate link or by texting give to 713-526-5738.
Yeah, we appreciate any support you can give us, even if that's just by listening to our shows. We appreciate, you know, all of the support that we receive from the community because it keeps us going. It keeps us, it's why we do this.
And I'll tell you what, aside from it's nice to hear from you guys either by email or blog post or Twitter post, it's also helpful if you have a show that you like, spread the word.
Yeah.
You know, if you like this show or some of the other shows on KPFT, let other people know. Say, you might want to sample this. It's kind of interesting. You can also go to archive.kpft.org and you can podcast many shows, including this one. So lots of different ways to support the station, help the station, enjoy the station.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next up. This is from the Texas Tribune, December 3rd. Greg Abbott tells supporters he's considering placing law enforcement for Central Austin under state control. It's the latest proposal from the governor to punish the capital city for its August decision to trim its police budget by a third. In his latest move in a political fight against Austin over police funding, Abbott says he's considering a proposal to put the state in charge of policing a large area in the middle of the city, including downtown, the Texas Capitol, and the University of Texas at Austin. Abbott floated the idea during a campaign teletown hall Wednesday while discussing his push to punish cities that, quote, defund the police during the upcoming legislative session, which begins in January. He has for months railed against the Austin City Council's vote to slash its police budget by a third, primarily by shifting some responsibilities out of law enforcement oversight. He has also already proposed measures such as freezing property tax revenues for cities that cut police budgets. And it goes on a little bit. My observation is how fascinating it has been to me for years that Republicans are always very into anti-federalism, local government, allowing cities and states to make their own choices. And this always applies until they have power.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden when they have power, it's like, well, this city can't do what they want, or this state can't do what they want, or this county can't do what they want, because we have the power to enforce what we think is the right thing to do. So much for local governance, right?
Yeah. It's Republicans will let you govern locally as long as you govern locally how they want you to.
Yeah, or they'll let you govern locally as long as they're the local governance and the opposition party isn't.
There you go.
It's a very consistent hypocrisy.
Yes.
From November 27th, this is actually a story that we ran across last week but didn't have time to get to. You may have already heard it. EPA's final deregulatory rush runs into open staff resistance. This is from the New York Times. Trump's Environmental Protection Agency was rushing to complete one of its last regulatory priorities, aiming to obstruct the creation of air and water pollution controls far into the future, when a senior career scientist moved to hobble it. Thomas Sinks directed the EPA's Science Advisory Office and later managed the agency's rules and data around research that involved people. Before his retirement in September, he decided to issue a blistering official opinion that the pending rule, which would require the agency to ignore or downgrade any medical research that does not expose its raw data, will compromise American public health. With 2 months left of the Trump regime, career EPA employees, I'm going to have trouble remembering to say administration after January 20th. I've been saying that for so long. EPA employees find themselves in a bureaucratic battle with the agency's political leaders, but now with the Biden administration on the horizon, they are emboldened to stymie Mr. Trump's goals and do so more openly. The filing of dissenting scientific opinion is an unusual move. It signals that Andrew Wheeler, the administrator of EPA, and his political appointed deputies do not listen to the objections of career scientists in developing regulation. More critically, by entering the critique as part of the official Trump record on the new rule, Dr. Sink's dissent will offer Biden's EPA administrator a powerful weapon to repeal the so-called secret science policy. Better late than never, Andrew?
Yeah. you know, the EPA and every other federal agency has been at the mercy of someone who is blatantly unashamed about using it for the benefit of the upper class.
Well, these are basically Trump political appointees who are doing Trump's bidding because that is why they are Trump political appointees.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, it's great that we're finally kicking them out, you know. Mm. At least I hope we're kicking them out. That technically has yet to be seen.
Well, I think that the political appointees, as a matter of democracy, tradition, requirement, generally the political appointees turn in resignations and leave it up to the incoming president to decide who that person wants to invite to continue in their roles.
Okay.
I think it's safe to say that 99% of the Trump political appointees, and I say 99% because, for example, Fauci is going to continue in his role.
Mm.
There may be a few that have been doing a decent enough job that they might be invited or permitted to stay on for a while. But generally, anyone who doesn't turn in a resignation that may or may not be accepted, if they're not wanted, they'll be fired.
Mm.
And that's not generally what they like on their political resumes.
Right.
I think the real problem is due to some obscure civil service rules, Trump has, I hear, managed to essentially get people to get in as moles that he was able to hire that may be difficult to fire because they'll become civil servants rather than political appointees.
Right.
My feeling on that is, you know, if you can't fire somebody, you can disconnect them from areas of responsibility.
Mm.
And if they end up being given a desk in a basement with no responsibilities and they can read books and newspapers and watch TV, if they're not doing damage, I'm okay with that. That's a worthwhile expense of government money, in my opinion. Sort of like defusing a time bomb.
Hmm.
Okay, next up, and staying along the lines of environment and technology, this is, I thought, an interesting story from November 19th. Cleantechnica.com, solar panels plus agriculture, you ain't seen nothing yet. And the story goes, it seems like only yesterday that the idea of combining solar panels with agriculture was just a twinkle in somebody's eye. But all of a sudden, the field is exploding. In the latest development, the U.S. Department of Energy is putting down $7 million to sow the seeds for a new revolution in American farming. If deploying solar panels to assist the pursuit of growing things seems a bit counterintuitive, there's a good reason for that. Until very recently, solar arrays have been the enemy of agriculture. Typical solar developments have involved essentially covering over rows of land with PV photovoltaic panels that could be used for growing crops for people and livestock. The income from solar leases does provide a lifeline for farmers. However, the current if the current trend continues, the U.S. and other nations would bump into a global food supply issue. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory, for one, has estimated the U.S. alone could lose 2 million acres of land to solar panels, but in the best of all possible worlds, solar panels could be raised just a few feet extra off the ground, enabling farmers to benefit from the renewable energy income while also growing crops or livestock in among the photovoltaics. Clean Technica caught wind of the trend a while back when researchers at Oregon State University described how solar arrays can create a cooling microclimate that enhances the environment for various crops. They also gathered evidence that the same cooling effect improves the efficiency of solar panels. Interestingly, solar panels become less efficient when they become hotter.
Hmm.
So it's the reason, for example, why you can't turn blast furnaces that smolt metal into photovoltaic farms, because at those temperatures, even if you somewhat cool the panels so that they don't melt,
right,
at that temperature, they are very inefficient.
Right. Okay.
Now, an interesting thing here as well is, if you think about it, animals generally are seeking out shade. So solar panels are beneficial to farm animals that don't want to be in the sun all the time. You'll notice when you drive in rural areas, they tend to cluster under trees.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah.
Also, there are some crops that don't grow as well in full southern sun. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you will often see green mesh, green screening, put over certain rows of crops to help shade them somewhat.
Ah, that's what that is. Okay.
Yes. So, again, there are some crops that might actually grow better if they don't get full sun all day. So, again, solar panels can actually be beneficial in that regard. I think the trick is going to be accomplishing this while still providing space for farm machinery to get in and do its job in terms of seeding and weeding and spraying and harvesting.
Yeah. I mean, the immediate thing that comes to mind is, you know, when I read this article, for me, is the same thing that always comes to mind when I see anything about renewable energy is, you know, make sure that the land use is responsible, make sure that it's not, you know, going to wreck ecosystems, because, you know, destroying an ecosystem for environmentalism's sake is a bit, you know, pointless and ridiculous. I think, you know, it's great in any kind of big power generation projects, especially these environmentalist focused power generation projects, if, you know, native peoples can be consulted, native peoples from the area can be consulted, because, you know, they have a lot of generational knowledge about how to take care of the land. But what you mentioned specifically about animals looking for shade, that reminds me of, I forget whether this was a concept I saw or whether it was something that was actually implemented, and I don't remember where it was, where in the world, but I saw an image of like a parking lot that had basically like those gas station like roofs that they kind of put over the pumps, built over it with solar panels along the top. So it's generating solar power while also keeping the parking lot cool and keeping the sun off the cars so it doesn't heat them up inside. So, you
know. People and their cars, much like farm animals, like to park in the shade.
Right, exactly. And
so you always find the cars first parking wherever the trees are shading, but of course, right, as the sun moves, that alters. But yeah, we're all looking for some shade.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, you know, this idea of putting solar panels on top of things, stacking solar panels on top of things.
That's already being used, but that doesn't provide anything productive.
Right.
I think really, though, when we talk about renewables, unless you're talking about windmills, which the wind is pretty much always blowing to one degree or another, storage capacity for photovoltaics will ultimately make the difference. And aside from batteries, there are lots of different schemes for them.
Right.
Even something as simple as filling up water towers during the day and letting the water drain down at night and drive generators. Yeah. I mean, it's all kinds of stuff, but apparently nothing has actually been the silver bullet.
That, I really quickly, that there was some experimenting being done into using electric cars as a sort of distributed power grid battery system. So basically, when you plug in, the grid can sort of check how much power it has, where it needs power from, and can either take some power out of your car or, you know, put it back in or whatever. And, you know, if it takes some of the battery, of the energy out of your battery, you get reimbursed for that. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I think I've seen various suggestions for that, from using an electric car as an emergency power source if you lose power from the grid, or having it connected into what is already a solar-powered home where you're already getting reverse metering. There are a lot of different ideas, but all of them require some degree of change in infrastructure, both in terms of the grid and in terms of power. homes and buildings generate incoming and outgoing, or deal with incoming and outgoing power. And at some point, we're going to talk about lithium, but not this week. But we're going to get to that eventually. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. We have links to all the stories we discuss on my website, thinkwingradio.com. Just go to the blog tab and you can find the shows from various dates and everything we've discussed with sourcing, because I believe in providing information on what we talk about to
absolutely sort of
support it and back it up and let you know that I'm not just making things up as I go along. We are still doing pre-recorded shows, so unfortunately for the time being cannot take live calls, but you can contact us. You can communicate with us. We invite you to. You can either go to my blog post for individual shows and put a comment for the show or a question or a suggestion. You can also write to me at ThinkWing Radio on Twitter, and I respond to most comments. You can also go to Facebook, and I'm on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio, and you can post something either to a show post or just generally on the blog. So lots of different ways to contact us. And of course, Andrew has something.
Yes, I do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr, spelled the same, at DominateI.tumblr.com. I welcome all manner of comments, questions, suggestions about our politics, about, or my politics, I guess, not so much Mike's, about what we say on the show, about how we do the show. Even if you just want to tell us that we're doing a bang-up job.
That would be our preference.
Mm.
But, you know, if we're not doing a bang-up job, you can tell us why you think that. You're entitled to your opinion, but not your own facts. Okay, and also, support KPFT, your community radio station. Keep shows like Think Wing Radio or the music shows or some of the other political shows or informational shows. There are like 100 different shows on KPFT, 100 different titles. So 713-526-5738 is where you can text the word give, 713-526-5738. And whatever you can afford, whether it's a few dollars or a bunch of dollars or a whole lot of dollars or a small monthly contribution, $5, $10 a month, all of that is appreciated. And going through the process, you can pick whatever show you want to support and how you want to support it, etc.
You can also go to kpft.org and click on the donate button there. There's a form there where you can specify how much you want to donate if you want it to be recurring. And you can set what show you'd like to donate in the name of, if that, as well as what thank you gifts you're interested in receiving. There are some pretty good thank you gifts, I think. We
mugs,
would appreciate
shirts, bags,
archive items. Yeah, CDs and DVDs and flash drives of music as well, which I think is legal. any you know, support you can give us would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, moving on to the next story. From CNN, December 3rd. This is actually kind of interesting. Salmon have been dying mysteriously on the West Coast for years. Scientists think a chemical in tires may be responsible. I'll preface this with, when your tires wear out, have you ever wondered where that wear has gone? This is that. For decades, scientists say something alarming has been happening in the streams and rivers where coho salmon return from the Pacific Ocean to spawn along the West Coast. After heavy rain events each fall, the fish have been turning up dead in huge numbers before they spawn, a mysterious phenomenon that has been the subject of intense research for years. Now, scientists think they found a key piece to this morbid puzzle, and according to a new study, it's strewn all over North America's roadways. It starts with a chemical antioxidant known as 6-PPD, used in tires to make them last longer. As tire treads break down over time, they leave behind bits of microplastics on the road. The 6-PPD in them reacts with ozone to become a different chemical, a previously unreported byproduct called 6-PPD quinone. This chemical is toxic to coho salmon. Researchers found its presence in roadway runoff samples taken from across the West Coast, leading them to conclude it's likely the main cause of population decline. The scientists say, we believe that 6 ppd quinone is the primary causal toxicant for these observations of coho salmon mortality in the field. I think I love scientific ease. It's exciting to start to understand what's happening because that starts to allow us to manage these problems more effectively. The scientists said more research is needed to understand whether this chemical is toxic to other aquatic species and even humans, given its prevalence in the environment. Quote, it would be surprising if these salmon are the only sensitive species of fish. Mm. I think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah.
And I guess the fish that don't die from this contamination that maybe get eaten may be carrying microscopic amounts of these PPD quinones to the consumers.
Yeah. I feel like I remember, God, I don't remember what the actual problem chemical or problem element was. But I remember there was
something a big, that leaches out of plastic liners.
Yeah, there was
and foods.
A big issue a couple years back about a fish of some sort having eaten like garbage or something, and then getting eaten by larger fish that were actually farmed, and that was making it onto customers' plates. And so, yeah, I mean, this isn't just something that affects, you know, the population density of different species. This affects the quality of our food. It affects our health.
Goes up and, the food chain.
Yeah, it goes up the food chain. I mean, I guess, you know.
And also consider there are wild animals that will find these dead salmon and think that's a free buffet. And now those animals are being contaminated with perhaps accumulating amounts of these toxic chemicals.
That's true. It goes
bears
up the food.
Are an excellent example. Bears are opportunistic feeders. You see a dead salmon, you're a bear, you're eating it.
Yeah, it goes up the food chain, not just to humans, but to other species. I guess it's good that we, you know, have found what may be the problem now. I mean, the first step to solving a problem is admitting you have it, but the second step to solving a problem is figuring out what causes it. So,
right.
You know, maybe we can do something about it now.
Yeah, that would be nice. Okay. The next story is from Business Insider from 11/28. It was something we wanted to talk about last week, but didn't have time. It's called Facing the First Loss of Their Voting Lives. Young Republicans are surprisingly hopeful, but want the GOP to work for Generation Z. And this kind of goes to a point I've made many times, that parties aren't just labels. They are the people in them that drive policy. So as you listen to this article, or if you go and read it, this could be a hint of a more liberal Republican Party perhaps going forward. We're in the process of a generational leadership change now, similar to the 1990s. The cohort in this article will start taking power in about 10 years in a process that will culminate in a leadership changeover within the Republican Party, probably by the 2050s, which seems like a long time, but it's already almost 2021. And that could be really interesting for those of us still around to see it. So the article goes, for many members of Generation Z, Donald Trump's defeat in 2020 was the first loss in their voting lives. We're talking now about young people in their late teens, early 20s. Business Insider recently spoke to the senior members of 5 college Republican groups across the country for their reaction. They were all largely optimistic about the GOP's future, with the party poised to control the Senate and whittling down the Democrats' House majority as a result of the 2020 election. But they also said, and this is where it starts getting interesting, that the GOP needs to reassess its image and platform to win over their fellow Generation Zers, including getting serious about tackling climate change and making the economy fairer. Sounding a little bit more like Blue Dog Democrats, maybe. While they said they were pleased with some of Trump's accomplishments in office, they were largely critical of his personality and had mixed feelings about Trump's future in the GOP. Business Insider spoke to senior members of five college Republican groups. All five leaders who spoke were men, reflecting the still mainly male makeup of the party. Far from mourning Trump's defeat, the five young men were optimistic about their party's better-than-expected down-ballot performance. We talked about that, the fact that Biden had very short coattails, and that it appears mainly that you had he was taken over the top by anti-Trumpers more than pro-Bideners. But we don't know how much of that is because of successful voter suppression by various means keeping Democrats from voting. It's an unknown, in my opinion. But these five men also didn't shy away from critiquing the current state of Republicanism. Generation Z, currently in age from 8 to 23, and their immediate elders, the millennials, who are 24 to 39, demographic breakdowns basically, have so far proven to be solidly Democratic voting blocks. 61% of voters 18 to 29 voted for Biden this year, just 36% for Trump, according to analysis by Tufts University. Republicans have a stronger grasp on running the country efficiently with things like the economy or foreign relations, but besides the economy, people vote on social issues such as free health care, LGBTQ rights, and other important issues, said David Morgan, chief of staff of the Penn State College Republicans. Now, I think that Andrew and I would probably argue his claim that Republicans have a stronger grasp on running the country efficiently. You know, there is a saying that when the framers created the Constitution, they didn't create it so that government was efficient. They created it so that government was safe. And whenever you hear about people talking about, well, we need a businessman to run the government because they know how to run things efficiently, efficiency is what autocrats do.
Yeah. We can debate how good the Constitution is and how much its framers anticipated the challenges it would face. But it's, I think we can both agree that a government run efficiently is not a good government. It's a right. government that doesn't it's really care about people because people are inefficient.
Well, I mean, the most efficient government arguably is royalty, where arguably, you have a king or an emperor, and what they say goes, and there's no debating it.
Yeah.
That's the peak of efficiency. So Republicans, efficiency is not what you want. Effectiveness.
Right. And so, I also want to quickly, foreign relations. Republicans have a stronger grasp on foreign relations. I'm going to disagree with that. Yeah, just wanted to say that, you know?
Yeah. I think pre-Trump, I think there were legitimate differences of opinion on foreign relations. I think that the Trump era has been the worst for foreign relations, certainly since the end of the Second World War, if not ever. One of the men interviewed, one of the young men said, the party should focus on making sure that marginalized groups have the same equal opportunity as anybody else. This person does not see the anti-abortion stance going away. Philip Anderson, co-chair of the Marquette University College Republican, said he thinks part of the Republican Party's problem is not so much its platform, but its inability to explain that platform to younger people. He said he believes young people are a lot more conservative than they may realize. I know you agree with me. You just don't realize it. Yeah, no ego problem, narrow vision there. Anderson says, everybody wants freedom, and yet a lot of those same people will tend to vote for government control, whether it's energy to combat the climate crisis or whether it's forcing the minimum wage to be raised to combat poverty. And it's stuff like that that slowly erodes people's freedoms. Lower taxes means more freedom for you. It means that you can do what you want with your own dollar, he said. I don't think we need to argue that. I think that the fallacy and self-deception is obvious enough, at least to people listening to this show, so that we don't need to spend a lot of time discussing
it. I mean, you know, from an anti-capitalist standpoint, the freedom people want, in my opinion, is freedom from capitalism. But I think from a general standpoint, the freedom people want is freedom from getting screwed, which, you know, is what happens when you reduce the ability of government to provide for its people. People get screwed more often. That's my opinion.
Franklin Roosevelt coined a term which you kind of made me think of that I think we need to talk about maybe more than we have over the years. What he called the four freedoms, articulated by Franklin Roosevelt on January 6, 1941, in what is known as the Four Freedoms Speech, which was actually the 1941 State of the Union. Okay. These are the four freedoms that Roosevelt thought were imperative: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I think that that pretty much sums it up. Freedom from want means you should be able to put food on your table. You should have a roof over your head. Freedom from fear, you don't have to worry about a midnight knock on your door or worry about suddenly being homeless. Freedom of worship, or freedom to not worship for that matter. Free speech. The government cannot control your speech, but you're not guaranteed a platform by private enterprise. I mean, these things, I think, sum it up. And maybe we need to focus more on those.
Yeah, I think...
Have you ever heard of them before, being a 22-year-old? Is that something you've ever encountered?
I hadn't run across that, no. I mean, it's not impossible that it wasn't... It could have been taught in classes where I wasn't paying attention. But... Also,
I think, you know, the further away we get in time from some of these things, they tend to get lost.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, you know, we might want to look at the message and see if we can update it for the modern day a little bit, but see if it needs that. But I mean, yeah, I think in general, that is basically what people want. People want to be able to live their lives in a way, that they feel is personally fulfilling, where they feel secure, and where they feel like they have control over, you know, they're not powerless as to influencing what their government does. So, you know, I agree with you. We should be talking about those four freedoms more.
And of course, what's ironic is that in order to guarantee those freedoms, you need a government to guarantee them.
That's true.
So libertarians and very conservative Republicans who constantly want smaller government and government less intrusive into their lives, that means that they want freedom either to be able to restrict other people's four freedoms, or they want the freedom for other people to possibly impact their ability to exercise the four freedoms, because it becomes a matter of power.
Yeah. I mean, there's political thought that is trying to figure out how you can guarantee those four freedoms or something like them without having a centralized, you know, actual government. But certainly for the world we live in right now, you can't guarantee those things without government that can actually do things. So...
And government that is under enough democratic small d control that the government itself doesn't take those freedoms away. This is all a dynamic tension.
Yeah.
Government can be too weak to guarantee the freedoms or strong enough to deny those freedoms.
Yeah.
And that's part of where public participation in government, in politics, to make sure that neither side gets too weak or too strong. That's really the only way to guarantee those freedoms. And I'll probably have to post something about that either on the Facebook side or on the blog side.
So follow ThinkWing Radio.
Yeah.
So follow ThinkWing Radio and look forward to that.
Exactly. Because you never know what's going to pop up somewhere on these sites. Okay. And this is kind of interesting. This is actually from November 18th, and I will admit I don't know if there has been a follow-up story. It's from NJ.com, a New Jersey website. New Jersey congressman says Trump should be tried for crimes against our nation and Constitution. New Jersey Rep. Bill Pascrell Jr., one of Trump's fiercest critics on Capitol Hill, is demanding the president and his aides be investigated and prosecuted after they leave office. Pascrell of the Democrat from the 9th District, New Jersey, said late Tuesday, of course this is a couple of weeks ago, that a failure to do so would embolden criminality by our national leaders and continue America down the path of lawlessness and authoritarianism. And there's rather more that goes with that article. I think what's interesting is, you know, in 2006, mm-hmm. when the Democrats took over Congress while George W. Bush was president, and one of the first things that Nancy Pelosi said was, we will not be impeaching George W. Bush. And a lot of Democrats got really, really upset about that. And that was, of course, my first impulse as well. But, you know, my thinking was that what she was trying to do, what I think she was trying to do, was to avoid a cycle of constantly impeaching the other party's presidents. I think a case could be made that the Clinton impeachment was revenge for the Nixon push to resign. Mm-hmm. I think that the Republicans probably see the Trump impeachment as revenge for the Clinton impeachment. That's probably how they see it. Mm. Biden has, and Biden, I think, has left some people kind of with a misunderstanding. Obviously, time will tell. But what Biden said was he would not seek to have the Department of Justice investigate or indict Trump or any of his family or cronies. And that's the part that seems to have taken hold in Democratic and progressive consciousness. But what he also said was he would not seek to control the Department of Justice if the Department of Justice sought to investigate or indict them. Mm. So, in a sense, what he's trying to do is reestablish the principle that the president doesn't say who should or should not be investigated, who should or should not be indicted. What he's saying is, I'm going to have in place people in the Department of Justice, and they will do the job of the Department of Justice, and I am not going to interfere saying what they should or should not do. That's essentially the position Biden has taken, which kind of leaves us all with a cliffhanger. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, of course, there are the various city and state investigations and not just right. New York. So, you know, right. a lot of things are going to happen after January 20th.
Yeah. I mean, on your point about the Democrats wanting to avoid a cycle of retaliatory impeachment, I understand why they would want to avoid that, because obviously an impeachment process is a big thing. It is a time-consuming thing. It takes away time that Congress could be spending on the normal business of Congress, the normal business of legislating. But, you know, I'm going to make a video game analogy here, and I'm sorry for anybody who is, you know, normal.
I may resemble that remark.
When you have a bunch of like health items or you know, special effect items in your inventory, right? And you don't want to use them because you're saving them for a big boss battle when you really need them. You know, you're about to die, but you think that if you could, you know, power through and get, you know, a couple more good shots and you could win the battle, that's when you want to save those items for, so that you can use them and have the ability to keep going. But what happens a lot is that, you know, you keep saving these items and saving them, and you get to the end of the game and you haven't used them. The game's over and you never used them because you were always saving them for something, some time when you really needed it. So I see this kind of as a similar thing, you know, the wanting not to start this cycle of retaliation is, you know, could have resulted in an unwillingness to use impeachment when it's appropriate, when the president has committed crimes or their judgment has harmed people in a very obvious and criminal way. Unfortunately, it still has to be criminal. You can't impeach a president for doing horrible things that were still legal.
But of course, the danger is that a portion of the electorate, a portion of the population, will see these charges as rigged up, and you're not really pursuing them for political crimes, but you're finding other crimes that will still serve the same purpose of finding them, putting them away, incarcerating them. You know, I think that the Trump regime will probably go down as the most corrupt in American history. I think it'll take time because the wheels of justice grind exceedingly finely. But I think over time, you're going to find a lot of people have crossed various lines. Now, whether there will be pardons or not, I don't know. Whether those pardons will cover all their crimes, I don't know. Whether any of those pardons can or will be contested in court, I don't know. Nobody knows. This whole presidency is unprecedented.
Right.
Easy to get those two words confused.
Mm.
But when you start going after political players, there is going to be a portion of the population that feels that you're sort of going after them.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have had presidents who have done things that we're not proud of, have done things that might have been illegal, certainly politically undesirable. But we have never sent a president to court. We have never sent a president to jail. It would be a big step forward or backward, or both simultaneously. Tough, tough call. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host, as always, and my indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson, and I thank him for all his work, past, present, and future. We'll be back next week. We'll look forward to talking to you then. Do stay in touch. We'd appreciate it. You all have a great week. Take care.
See you later, folks.